Thank you very much. You can imagine how impressive it is to speak after the talk we just heard, and it really changed the life of the patients, these drugs, and it really changed the life of the physician who treat the patients. I would like to, after thanking my dear colleagues who invited me to this meeting, I think it's fascinating all what we hear. I would like to tell you what we do about trying to understand also how we can improve the outcome of our patients. And I work mainly on melanoma. And I will talk about the translational control and how it can be involved in resistance and maybe how we can use what we learned about this control in therapeutics. Okay. So I will give you a tour coming from the clinic, taking it from the from the perspective of the clinicians. Melanoma, it's a very good model to study immunotherapy. It's also patients who have these strange-looking moles that don't really look like a normal one. And if you look at it under the microscope, you see the epidermis, it's only 0.1 millimeter. And as soon as it goes beyond the basal membrane, it can give rise to metastasis. So it's a very small tumor that can give rise to a lot of metastasis that can go almost everywhere in all our organs. And before 2011, the median overall survival of the patients was between 6 and 12 months. Now, with the drugs that have been developed over the last 10 years, a little bit more, so immunotherapy, you know very well, but also targeted therapy. They are in green here. Targeted therapy for about 50% of the patients with melanoma because their melanoma harbor a somatic BRAF mutation that can be targeted with anti-BRAF or more efficiently with anti-BRAF plus anti-MEK. This gives rise to very high response rate, 70%, but as you can see here, at 15 months, approximately, you have the two superior curves, the red and the brown, that are the red anti-PD-1 single agent and anti-PD-1 plus anti-CTLA-4, the brown one that begin to be better and that remain on the top in terms of overall survival. Today, the best we can do to treat a patient with metastatic melanoma is to give the combination of ipilimumab plus nivolumab, anti-CTLA-4 plus anti-PD-1. We have 5-year overall survival for half of the patients. So it's a dramatic increase in overall survival. But it also means that 50% of the patients are dead after 5 years. So it's not the end of the story. I like also to show you, because you work on cancer and some of you don't see patients, and I want to tell you, I think you are all very motivated, but this couple, this woman, she had a very resistant metastatic melanoma. It was a long time ago. She was in palliative care after 3 lines of systemic treatment. She had not responded to ipilimumab, and then we finally had anti-PD-1 in the early phase of development, and we called her. She was living in a remote place in France, and we told her, well, if you are still in good performance status, we can maybe enroll you in a clinical trial with anti-PD-1. And you know, she had a lot of metastases. I show you with the arrows, even one behind the eyes, and she received anti-PD-1. Pembrolizumab. Initially, tumor grew, and then she responded totally. So she's one of the patients who is still now, after 10 years, in complete response, and I really hope she is cured. But I also show you this picture because at the time, the manuscript was online, not yet in hard copy, but online. The husband of this woman called me and told me, you know, Dr. Robert, I think... you made a mistake on your manuscript. And I said, well, thank you, Alain. Thank you very much. I didn't really believe him, but he was right. And that's to show you that the patient, they are 100% here behind us. He was right because he knew His wife had received ipilimumab, he was very involved, and I told him that in this trial, more patients had received ipilimumab than were naive of treatment, and he was really there. So the patients are there, they give good ideas, and they even correct our papers. Now, we are very happy when we see a regressive melanoma. You see this one, it's a very recently. We saw this patient in the clinic, and she had this primary melanoma that was already half destroyed by the immune system. But unfortunately, and as we heard with all the talks we had yesterday and today, unfortunately, sometimes the immune system does well in one place, but it does not do as we would like elsewhere. And is it because the lymphocytes could not go there? You will hear Jean-Philippe Girard later today. We will explain you some important data about how T cells can travel in the body and can extravasate or not in some places, in the melanoma model also. But maybe it's other situation, maybe the tumors are different, and this is really the problem, and the heterogeneity of evolution and the heterogeneity of response is also a big problem, as we heard by Ton earlier. We have a lot of patients who respond in one place and not in other places. We call that dissociated response. It's very difficult to manage. We are used to show a response with this so-called waterfall graph. So you see decrease on the right or increase on the left of the size of the target lesions. These are only target lesions. It does not mean that all the patients who have a 100% decrease are in complete response, because you can have some non-target lesions that are here, but you cannot be in complete response if you don't have 100% decrease of the target lesions. I want to show that because even when we are in the best situation, we know because we know the patients can sometimes relapse, that not all the cells have disappeared. Although we don't see anything clinically, we don't see anything with the CT scan, the MRI, the PET scan, etc. And there are various ways to resist to treatment. We can handle that from a Darwinian point of view, with cells that are already resistant upfront and that are selected, and we know also that there is this more Lamarckian point of view with plasticity, with exterior events that will modify the tumor and that will make them more resistant. Sometimes we don't know if it's present before, but it's non-genetic event that can sometimes be induced or selected by the treatment. And just to insist a little bit on the limitations of all what we try to do, I think we all try to do our best, but just to make you realize that we send the patient to the biopsy. Sometimes we have very good intervention radiologists, they can biopsy almost anywhere in the body, but even if they do their best, they will take a biopsy, and depending on where you biopsy in the tumor, you will arrive in an active zone with a lot of lymphocytes, so you will say, well, very good, the patient will respond. But if you just biopsy very close by in the tumor, in the middle of the tumor with no lymphocytes, it's different. And then a lot of paper who try to look for biomarkers have this limitation, all of them almost, except when you do like what Myriam told us last year, when you do neoadjuvant and you have the entire piece of the lesion, but it's a very, very limited situation in terms of number of patients. And also we have to pay a lot of attention, and also this was really highlighted earlier, by the fact that a lot of papers take the biopsy not always before treatment, but at any time point, and it's very different. You cannot compare what you see in a tumor if the tumor is already treated for even a few days with any kind of treatment. So we have a lot of limitations, but nevertheless, we need to try to find markers. I just would like to show you a very simple marker that can be done on one single fixed section of the patients. We heard yesterday about the importance of interaction between cells, the location, respective locations of cells and receptors. And we tried to see, because we know that PD-L1 is not a good marker for melanoma, we tried to see if we do a proximity ligation marker a test of proximity between PD-1 and PD-L1, because if PD-L1 is there but there is no lymphocytes around, it's not so interesting. In fact, it's quite a good predictive biomarker, and you can see on the panel on the below panel on the left. It's not easy to see, I think, from far away, but you see the little, very little dots. They are, each little dot is a PD-1, PD-L1 interaction. And it's more predictive than CD8 presence, than inflammation signature, than TMB, and then PD-L1. What I like in this marker, if we can develop it further, is that when you take melanoma that have not yet developed metastasis, that are very high-risk primary melanoma, and this is definitely this melanoma that we need to target to be really effective, and you take the ones that do not have metastasis in their lymph node, the lymph node, the sentinel node is negative. If you have a high PD-1, PD-L1 in the sentinel node that is negative, you have a high risk of relapse. So this, a marker that is a poor prognostic marker, but a good predictive marker, begin to become a good marker, because then we know the patient really needs a treatment and has a high probability to respond to the treatment. Now, if I would like to enter into the body of the role of translation control, I would like first to cite Stefan Wagner, because I met him more than 10 years ago. Stefan Wagner is leading a research team in Curie now, and he's an expert in RNA biology. And we discussed about our respective problems and purpose, and I told him about the resistance and all these patients who did not respond or who resisted secondarily. And he told me about what he was doing about his RNA experience. And we realized that probably there was a very interesting interface to develop together. So just here you see in a simplified way, the complex that initiates the translation of RNA with the backbone of 4G protein that binds to EIF4E, which binds to the 5' zone of RNA. And we have this helicase, EIF4A, that will unwind the RNA so that the ribosome have this landing pad and can initiate the translation. But what we realize with Stefan is that this complex is really downstream from very important pathway in cancer, the MAP kinase pathway, with the phosphorylation of EI4E by MINK, downstream from the PI3 kinase pathway with 4E binding protein that, when it's phosphorylated downstream from this activation of this pathway, cannot bind anymore to 4E, and thus the complex is activated. So we really wanted to explore that, and we developed, again, a proximity ligation assay that could show us if the complex was active or inactive, depending on the binding of 4E with 4G or with 4E binding protein. And we found in vitro and then in vivo that the activation status of this complex and the maintenance of this activation was really connected with resistance to targeted agents. And it was interesting because we have a patient, the patient number 4, who had one metastasis that responded and one metastasis that did not respond. And we really see the difference with the activation of the complex in the non-responding metastasis, whereas other markers were not differentiating, like phospho-ERK, for example. And then, so this was a work that was done. We showed that it was involved in resistance to BRAF or to BRAF-MEK, and also for the cells that were treated with anti-MEK when they had NRAS mutation, it was also involved. I mean, this complex was maintained activated. And then we tried to block this complex, and in a model, in a xenograft model, in vitro and then in a xenograft model, we found that when we combined and T4A with targeted agent, it was more effective. But then we really wanted to see what was happening during this sort of latency period when we don't see anything. And this can be seen with immunotherapy, because unfortunately patients can relapse also, even if it's less frequent, or with targeted agents. And reviewing all the mechanism that the cancer cells can use to have these persistent cells, we wanted to try to address some of them, and we used this first this in vitro model when you treat cells with targeted agents and you try to see what happens in terms, and we focused on the translation of RNA, and we saw that when the cells are treated with BRAF-MEC, some cells remain alive, and then they have, as expected, a very low level of translation. And this can be seen on the panel below with the sucrose gradients, and on the right you see the RNA that are bound to a lot of ribosomes. There are polysomes, so you see that there is a frank decrease of the RNA that are highly translated in the cells that are persistent, but if you leave the cells under the pressure of the treatment, you see that it comes back to the normal level of the parental cells. And we also see, and this has been shown also in other models, that these persistent cells give rise to resistance. We found that the RNA that were, the very small number of RNA that were highly translated were involved in chromatin remodeling epigenetic modifications. And when we silenced each of them separately, we had a decrease in number of persistent cells, but the best we could obtain was again when we decreased the activity of the complex EIF4F. And here, just to show you in a cloning experiment, when you give a regimen, when you give a targeted therapy plus an EIF4A inhibition, you have no clone growing. So this was the work that was done initially on targeted agents, and we found this epitranscriptomic mechanism, because what we found about this RNA is that they were highly methylated, they were MCCA methylated in their 5' region, and they were highly translated. So now, how does it translate into immunotherapy? Because of course, targeted therapy is an interesting model, but we also want to see how things, do we have the same kind of mechanism in immunotherapy, and how these persister cells can influence the immune system. So we did, we now have a protocol where we propose the patients to have biopsy before, that we did for a long time, but also very early during treatment and at 3 months and then at resistance. So as you can understand from what I said before, the patients, especially those who are really entering clinical trials, they usually are very participating. I mean, they are actively participating, they accept to do the biopsies, but even with a very participating patient, it's not so easy to have a very good material, so you're always a little bit disappointed by the number that you get at the end, even if you have a lot of people involved. What we did in this protocol, so it's an ongoing protocol, so I can show you preliminary data for the very clean sample that we had from our patients. Right now we have, it's close to 100 of biopsies, but it's only 27 patients that were sequentially biopsied. So we did CyTOF analysis. We designed some antibodies coupled with metal that were recognizing the proteins that were coded by the RNA that are highly expressed in persister cells. And also we used so these are proteins that are regulated at the translational level, but we also used to try to have a better idea of the persistent cells, antibodies against protein that are regulated, I mean, their RNA are regulated at the transcriptional level, but it has been very nicely published by the team of, I mean, Rainbow and Al, he was there yesterday, I think, our colleague from Belgium. These four contexts of cells like NGFR, SLIT1, MITF, and CD36 that are also very important in the persistence. So with this panel of antibodies, translational regulation, transcriptional regulation, and also a very large panel of antibody recognizing immune cells, and also immune checkpoint molecule, we explored the patients, and from the preliminary result that we have, and it could be with immunotherapy or with targeted therapy, first of all, we find these cells that have, according to us and to others, these persistent biomarkers. We can see some of them, a few of them present up front. And there is a tendency that when they are present up front, there is not such a good outcome. It's quite logical. It's not so easy to study because when you treat patients with targeted therapy, all of them respond, almost all of them respond. So you cannot have a readout of response rate. Doesn't mean anything. You need to wait for a long time because you need to look at the overall survival. Whereas for immunotherapy, there is a better correlation between response and survival. So it's easier. But here what we saw when we put all the patients together is that we have some cells that have these persistent biomarkers up front. When we look at the very early increase of persistent markers, it's not only a tendency, it's really associated with the overall survival. But it's a small cohort of patients, so we need to really document that with larger cohort. But we thought that it was interesting. And when we analyzed in a multivariate way how many markers of persistence were associated with a good outcome, we found that if you have more than 6 biomarkers of persistence, it's better than when you have less than 6 of them. Now, we are not yet at the point to have a good test to say, well, let's do an immunohistochemistry with this biomarker. It's still quite complicated with the site of analysis, and we also did the biopsies were also treated in a way that they can be studied in the codex, with the codex system with very nice images, and we now are in the process of trying to see what correlation we can have between the immune landscape, very early immune landscape, and the persister expression. What we saw until now is that there is immune cell that is associated with a good outcome. It's CD4, CD4 T cells. There was a tendency with CD8, but it was really quite strong with CD4. And we did not find, but we're still working on that, it's not finished, we didn't find a clear association between the expression of such and such a persistent marker and a specific immune landscape. What we try now is to go back to the lab and to see if the supernatant of our persistent cells does something special of the immune cells and the immune function. And what we find is that indeed, when you take the same numbers of parental and persistent cells, so persistent after BRAF-MEK, what you see is you have a differential effect on lymphocytes. We also have some preliminary results on monocytes where it also seems to do something, but we have these data were confirmed. On lymphocytes, you see a decrease of the marker of early marker of activation, and you also see that you have less proliferation of lymphocytes when you put the cells in contact of the supernatant of persister as opposed to parental. It's not vesicle, it's really in the supernatant, and we have some candidates in terms of cytokines, but I think it's a little bit early. But it is something that I think tells us that these cells who persist, who are totally invisible, they not only do they survive and they rearrange their RNA in a very smart way because maybe at the favor of a chromatin remodeling, they will find a way to have a real mutation of resistance and to develop largely, but also they do something probably not so good on our immune system. So that's why we now try with Stéphane to develop drugs that will act on this function of EIF4A, because we found that it's involved in resistance, in persistence, and maybe it does something on the immune system. We also have studied the effect of this complex on immune checkpoint receptor or their ligand, and we found that when you look at the effect of the different inhibitors of EIF4F of PD-L1 expression in different cell lines, there is a dramatic decrease of PD-L1 expression. But what was interesting, it was only when PD-L1, so this is done on tumor cells, only when PD-L1 is induced by interferon. When you have tumor cells that constitutively express PD-L1, it does not have this effect. Then we found in the other direction that when you have a high level of PD-L1 or a high proximity ligation assay between PD-1 and PD-L1, you have also a lot of activation of this complex EIF4F. So this is quite correlated, and it is also correlated with a good response to anti-PD-1. To understand better how it was working, we found that it was not regulated at the translational level, because the RNA of PD-L1 was decreased by the inhibitor that we use here, Silvestrol or the other inhibitors. And when we again did a polysome profiling on cells that have been activated, that have been treated by interferon, so we have an increase of PD-L1, and then if you look at the genes that are decreased in their expression under the effect of the EIF4F inhibitor, you see only 23 genes, and the one that is really the best candidate was STAT1, which has indeed, in its 5' prim untranslated region, a structure that is very, according to what we know on the genes that depend on EIF4A for their translation, that really has a structure that is very prone to be regulated by this machinery. And in fact, that's what we found, that when you use Silvestrol or any other inhibitor of EIF4A, you decrease the translation of STAT1. It's quite provocative in front of an assembly that really thinks that interferon is so important and that we should not touch to interferon to have a good effect. But in fact, here, Silvestrol, we found that it did not... it was decreasing STAT1 expression and decreasing PD-L1 expression via STAT1 decreased translation, but nevertheless, it was not decreasing T-cell functions, at least at the dose we use in vitro. And in vivo, when we give an inhibitor of EIF4A, we have, in this model of melanoma, BRAF mutant melanoma, we have an anti-tumor efficacy which relies on the immune system, because we lose it in nude mice or when we deplete of T cells. And when we take the same tumor cell lines, but we transfect with a plasmid that constitutively express PD-L1, so PD-L1 is not anymore under the control of EIF4F, we also lose the anti-tumor activity. So at least in this model, there is, I would say, an immunotherapeutic effect of EIF4A inhibitors. So now we look extensively at other immune checkpoints, and I was particularly interested to see that on this polysome profile, we also have a decrease of LAG1, of LAG3 and TIM3 expression, and we are now looking at other immune checkpoints. So clearly, if we modulate the activation of this initiation of the translation complex, we might have some effect on receptors that are important and that we would like to silence. And maybe we could use that, if we can use it with the right timing and the right dose, to have an immunotherapeutic effect. So my conclusion is that Yeah, F4F. I like this way of trying to attack the tumors, because what really kills the patients is that the tumor has this sort of bright intelligence of plasticity. And here we target the plasticity, and we do not run after one or another gene or cell or target. Our hypothesis is that reprogramming the translation is a way to adapt to whatever stress. Is one of the way to adapt. And if you hit with something that prevents this reprogramming, you might have an effect. And this is, there is also something that is not proven, but we try to develop models to show that. I'm quite convinced, but we need to prove that we need to do some, not continuous treatment, but we need to be much more intermittent, because each time you do something too strong, too much of a good thing becomes a bad thing. And I think it would be very interesting to find some sequential or turning treatment. So I won't repeat what I already said, but this is why we try to develop EIF4A inhibitors and to use them in a smart way. I would like to show my collaborators in the clinic and to cite the name of Émilie Routier, bright clinician who is taking care of the patients when I'm not here, Stéphane Wagner, he was in Curie, and Sarah Fauzi and Shenzi Shen, who did a lot of work on the persistent cells. Thank you very much.